Getting grouchy.
I just have a question.
Let's get started.
House Committee on Revenue for May 15th, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we have a member who's anxious to get off to other work, who is here on House Bill 3192. So we'll start with, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3192. Paul, do you want to give us the short version?
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3192 directs the Housing and Community Service Department to provide funds to assist first-time buyers. It establishes one of the sources of that fund would be the homeownership assistance account that's already established in statute. The fund is to be used for down payments, closing costs. Those are defined. The first-time home buyer is defined in the bill. It goes through and establishes a grant process, which the department, the housing department, would operate to make grants to nonprofit organizations. The bill then goes on to establish a home ownership down payment assistance fund, and that fund doesn't have a direct revenue source, but it has the indirect through appropriations and through interest earnings or money transferred from other governments and application fees. But then Section 6 of the bill does have a $5 million appropriation to the Housing and Community Service Department for the fund. And that's why the bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Representative Meek, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Meek for House District 40, Oregon City and Gladstone, Jennings Lodge and Johnson City. Can't leave them out. And I'm here today to speak to you about House Bill 3192. It comes to you from the House Committee on Human Services and Housing and passed out of committee with an 8-1 vote. It was referred to your committee by mistake. And I'm here today to hopefully get it moved on to Ways and Means where we can consider the fiscal. But I am excited to be in front of you today to speak a little bit about this bill that will boost our state's effort to support affordable home ownership. According to the U.S. Census Bureau Housing Vacancy Survey, home ownership rates in Oregon have declined since 2004. And part of that issue is that it's hard to come up with a down payment. The Housing and Community Services Department offers programs to Oregonians interested in becoming homeowners through homeownership education, counseling, and a residential loan program to help increase home purchasing, their power, and to maintain affordable housing house payments. The existing down payment assistance program provides up to $20,000 in down payment assistance to qualified families with modest means who otherwise would not be able to become homeowners. For example, I've been selling real estate for 20 years now, and when I first started first-time home buyers, they were looking at $100,000 as a first-time home buyer price. Then if you had a FHA mortgage, it was about a 3% down payment. You needed to come up with about $3,000 in closing costs. For about $5,000, you could get into a house. Today, the median home price of homes in Portland metro area are $350,000. And I'm working with first-time home buyers now that have to come up with a down payment for a $300,000 to $400,000 house. And that we're looking into the $12,000 and $15,000 price range. So this bill will increase the amount of funds available up to $5 million, which will be administered through the OCHS programs for those eligible nonprofit organizations, housing authorities, and local governments in order to provide the financial assistance necessary for our first-time home buyers. So while this is not a complete solution, it will provide a meaningful boost to assist first-time home buyers from low-income households. The $5 million investment will enable us to assist at least 250 first-time home buyers throughout the state of Oregon. We have to send it down to Ways and Means for the fiscal impact, and we're just hoping that there's enough funds to help stabilize our housing community. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Let's hear from the rest of the panel, and we'll take questions.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ryman. I'm the executive director of NEDCO, which is a nonprofit regional housing center currently funded through Oregon Housing and Community Services. We are an administrative partner on the current down payment assistance funding that's available for the state, and we hope to be an administrator of this new source of down payment assistance funding. I brought with me today a graph that I think is being handed out right now that really provides a visual for what Representative Meek just referenced in terms of how unaffordable homeownership is getting in Oregon. The top graph that you're looking at, the red line represents median home prices in the state of Oregon, and the green line represents median income in the state of Oregon. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, when median income households wanted to go out and buy a home, they were looking at median home prices that were right around twice the median income. We're now looking at home prices that are five and six times the median income. So what we're seeing is generations of low-income and working-class families who are not going to be able to afford home ownership, and as a result of that, they're not going to be able to afford the housing and financial security that comes with home ownership. Right now, the state has about $1.2 or $1.3 million available in its current down payment assistance funding program. That money comes from the doc recording fee. It goes to nonprofits like NEDCO who educate a pipeline of aspiring first-time low-income buyers, but it is a drop in the bucket compared to our need. NEDCO generally sees about 400 low-income families each year in Lane, Marion, and Clackamas County who want to become first-time buyers. Through the current funding, we get 12 DPA awards to serve every low-income family in that territory. The DPA is a really powerful tool. We provide it in the form of silent second loans, which means it stays as a lien on the house, accumulating zero interest and requiring zero payments until the homeowner sells that house or refinances it down the road, at which point it's paid back to us and we can revolve it to help the next low-income family. It provides a really important tool in two ways. One is that it helps families overcome that upfront hurdle of closing costs and down payment assistance. With our current rental crisis, many moderate income families are paying 50% and above of their income in rents, which means they may have steady income, they may have great credit, they may be able to get a mortgage that is cheaper than the rent they're paying, but the rents that they're paying prohibit them from saving enough to get over that upfront hurdle. The other important thing that it does is help buy down the mortgage just a little bit. In Lane County, what we're seeing is that moderate income families can afford a mortgage of $170,000 or $180,000, but there's no stock available at that level. If we can layer down payment assistance with something like an individual development account, we can get that family into a home that is maybe $190,000, and there are units available at that price range. So these down payment assistance awards are hugely important in our efforts to get low and moderate income families into homeownership, and we plain old don't have enough of them. I'd really encourage you to pass this along to Ways and Means, and help us try to get additional funding. I would also note that this is closely tied to our efforts this year among homeownership advocates to double the document recording fee, which would take that $1.2 or $3 million and double it, getting us closer to that $5 million goal for the state. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Ariel Nelson. I'm the Government Relations Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. We have no position on this bill, but I am here and available if you have any questions about our current program or how this one would affect us. Thanks.
Very good. Questions for this? Start clear at the end. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. Great concept. How would you assure geographic equity of the investment in this program? There's been problems through OHCS in the past with dollars being concentrated in some counties at the expense of others.
Ariel might be able to address this for the department. I know as a regional housing center, which is the network that disperses the current document recording fees, that the department has done a lot of work with us to ensure that the regional housing center dollars and the down payment assistance dollars have geographic equity in how they're dispersed. There was a work group put together with members from all of the regional housing centers, which cover every county in the state, that met for about a year to help the department come up with a more equitable funding distribution model. And we feel really happy with that coverage now for the current funding. I would assume that the new dollars would follow the same allocation method.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Buehler, I would agree with what Emily says as well. I believe there is some language in the bill that refers to geographic disbursement as well, that the agency will take that into account.
Follow up, please.
Please. Mm-hmm.
Could you provide me with recent data with regards to geographic distribution of funds from your agency?
Absolutely.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Thank you for coming. I would agree with my colleagues up here. Great concept. Whatever we can do to get more homes in the hands of families, I think, is a great step forward. But I did have some questions about the eligibility standards here. It says this is a first-time homeowners program, but the requirement is a 3 year that 3 years prior that they not have owned a home. So 4 years ago, could they have owned a home, sold it, and once again be eligible for a down payment?
That is my understanding, Rep. Marsh, members of the committee. To provide a little clarity, a common example of families we might be working with in that situation, we have aspiring homeowners come to us who owned a home jointly with a spouse who they divorced, mm-hmm. And are no longer homeowners and are wanting to buy one on their own. If that had been 4 or 5 years ago, they would qualify. We're also starting to see people who lost their homes to foreclosure early in the crisis come back and want to try to buy again. According to many of our program regulations, they can qualify again for assistance if enough time has lapsed. The vast majority of people that we see have never owned before.
Okay, and follow up. The other eligibility requirement that I had some questions about was 6 months residency in Oregon. That seems like a very short period of time to qualify for such a mm-hmm. gift.
Rep. Marsh, members of the committee, we talked about that in the drafting of the bill. One of the unwritten parts of the bill is that somebody will have to qualify for a mortgage. This is assuming that they're leveraging a traditional first mortgage. And very typically, there are requirements that go with that, that somebody has to have been at the same job for at least 2 years or shown some sort of income history for 2 years. And so our assumption is that most people will have been here for 2 years or longer. But we wanted it to potentially be available to families who may have relocated to Oregon for work and are looking to buy their first home. That's certainly something that we could negotiate if there were concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree. The 6 months caught my eye, attention. Even the Oregon Promise tuition waiver, we require 1 year of residency plus a high school diploma to qualify. So just the appearance-wise, it seems like 6 months is awful short. But what requirement is then that they remain a resident of the state? Continue to locate here, let's just say, so that they wouldn't qualify for a mortgage or qualify for a home purchase here, move their taxable status to Washington, let's just say.
Sure. Rep. Johnson, members of the committee,
benefit.
One of the requirements of the silent second loan is that they remain a resident of the house. So it has to be their primary residence, which means if they were to turn it into a rental and leave the area, or if they were to leave, they would need to repay the silent second at that point, and we would revolve it to the next homeowner.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you so much. I will say I'm looking hard. I haven't found the tax piece in here yet. I am beginning to wonder why it came to this committee rather than going to Ways and Means. But does anybody know?
It got out of committee on time, Chair Barnhart. Yeah.
I was looking for the same.
Right.
Same thing.
Paul, do we know?
Could have indeed just been an accident.
It was originally had the two-step or three-step process where it came from housing to revenue. It wasn't something that was added on.
Right.
So it was from the original bill assignments.
Okay. All right.
We were given the subsequent and then the further subsequent to Ways and Means. So they were both originally.
Anybody can make a mistake, including the referrer. But I'd be a lot more comfortable if I knew that that's what had happened rather than that they had some other idea mm-hmm. that we're just not picking up on. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, committee members.
Yeah, looks great. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3192. And let's see, we have witnesses on 149, don't we?
We do, Mr. Chair.
Senate Bill 149. So we'll open the public hearing on a Senate Bill 149.
Thank you.
Ah, we've got them all. Okay. Give us the short version, and then we'll hear from our witnesses.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 149, brief version. The change that the bill is making, it's making a change to an existing property tax exemption statute. That's ORS 307-022. And a thing of note is 307-022 is, while it is technically a property tax expenditure, it is really a look-through statute. So it's actually looking through to the other existing property tax exemptions that are on the books. And so what it does, current law, is it's allowing a limited liability company that's made up of nonprofits that own a piece of property that otherwise qualifies and is used in accordance with other property tax exemption statutes, that LLC can qualify for the property tax exemption. What SB 149 is doing is it's making a change. It's making really a series, I would say, three primary changes where it's adjusting the LLC could also include the ownership of a government owner, in this case something that's exempt under 307-090, so that'd be state or other local governments, could be an owner of the LLC and still qualify for that look-through exemption of another property tax exemption. A thing of note is also, so the important thing to remember is to qualify for the property to be exempt, it does have to qualify for another exemption. It has to be used in accordance with that, another property tax exemption. And it does qualify to the least extent that any of the nonprofit owners would qualify for. So if there's three owners, one of the nonprofits would qualify for a 50% exemption. That's the exemption the piece of property gets, regardless if the other two owners would qualify for the 100% exemption.
All right. Gentlemen, welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, Phil Donovan here on behalf of Life Flight Network. First off, thank you to the chair and the vice chairs for scheduling this for a hearing here. Prior to Senate passage, which was a unanimous vote, we worked with the Department of Revenue, the Association of Oregon Counties, and of course your Legislative Revenue Office staff to bring you what I believe is a consensus product. So with me is Mr. Greg Chamoff, who will provide an explanation of the bill for the record. Try not to steal your thunder, though, Kyle. Anyways.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, representing Life Flight Network. In 1993, the Legislative Assembly authorized businesses to organize as limited liability companies. They are a simple form of organization and therefore cheaper to operate than corporations are, and they are ideal when there is a small number of owners for a business. In 2005, at the request of the Oregon State Bar, the Legislative Assembly adopted ORS 307.022, which allows, as your staff explained, the property of an LLC to be tax exempt if its owners are nonprofit corporations. The problem that we're here asking you to solve is a problem that Life Flight Network has. It is owned by three nonprofit corporations and OHSU. If Life Flight were only owned by the three nonprofit corporations, then ORS 307.022 would authorize the company to get a tax exemption for its property. If OHSU were operating separately and performing the same services, OHSU would be tax exempt, but because Life Flight is a combination of three nonprofit corporations and a public entity that is tax exempt, the corporation, the company in this case, becomes tax exempt. And our request of you is to change ORS 307-022 to allow the kind of public-private partnership that LFN is, so that the company can take advantage of the tax advantages that would otherwise be available if the public and the private were operating separately. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right. I want to make certain that I follow the logic in this proposal. I think what we heard from Kyle was that the entity has to be subject to a tax exemption in its own right, because of the purpose of its operations.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Three nonprofits and a public entity that perform tasks that don't qualify as nonprofit or charitable wouldn't be able to take advantage of the exemption.
All right. So I want to make sure I understand that you recall the really, really ancient case at this point where a clearly nonprofit organization has wholly controls a for-profit business. And the question then is the for-profit business exempt, or the property that for-profit business owns, is that tax exempt? And of course the court findings are that no, it's not. If it's operated for profit, even though it's owned by a nonprofit, mm-hmm. it's not tax exempt. Does this bill have any effect on that ruling?
Mr. Chair, unequivocally, no.
So the operation of the limited liability corporation would have to qualify for exemption itself?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Right. Mr. Chair, that's precisely what Kyle said, and I would go on the record and say that in the Senate hearing, we were asked and put on the record that Life Flight Network does not operate any for-profit activities.
Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on line 10 of the Angros bill, it reads, or entities whose, why doesn't that just say, or not-for-profit corporations? Why does it, I'm just curious if that's a broader term than that which is used in the next couple of lines.
I'm embarrassed to say I don't have the Angros. I brought the 149. So line 10?
Line 10, the language reads, or entities whose property is exempt. And I just was, then the language throughout is not-for-profit corporations, and so I just wondered why they shifted over.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I would defer to Mr. Dale. However, my expectation is that entities is used because entities would describe the form of the form of public body that would combine with the nonprofit corporations, and entities is intended to be broad so that it wouldn't just have to be OHSU, which is a public corporation, but could be a county or some other form of entity that qualifies for tax exemption under ORS 307090.
Right, and I pulled it up quickly while you were talking, and it basically says state and all public corporate property used or intended for corporate purposes of several counties, cities, towns, school districts, irrigation districts, drainage districts, ports, water districts, housing authorities, public universities listed in, there's another number, and all other public or municipal corporations in this state is exempt from taxation. So that's what that references to.
Right, Mr. Chair, if I may, that means then that the language in 12, 13, and 14 really wouldn't apply to those entities because we wouldn't have to be worried about it since they are all government entities.
I think Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Right. Right. Yes, Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would share that I fully support this concept. I just don't understand. Wouldn't it have been cleaner for these three entities just to create a nonprofit and have the LLC sell the assets to it and just be done with the LLC?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, for purposes of getting a tax exemption, that might very well have been the case, a way to achieve that, but the purpose of operating as a limited liability company is that you can avoid many of the formalities that need to be adhered to when you are operating a corporation, thereby saving operating expenses. And when the entity is created specifically to be providing a charitable service, the less you spend on the administration and the operation of the business, the better.
Love to trust you. Sounds good.
Okay. I wouldn't be surprised either if they had some issue having to do with governance as well.
Mr. Chair, that would make sense, particularly if a public entity were involved, because public entities do have some limitations on the corporations in which they can participate.
Yeah. Other questions?
All right. Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could, we would very much appreciate having this scheduled for a work session.
Thank you. Appreciate that. All right. With that, we'll close public hearing on House Bill 149. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 148. Colleagues, for those who have been here before, you know this is one of those bills that LC spends time on trying to bring our laws into the 21st century. And unless he says something different, I assume that it means that we're not actually changing the substance of anything. Paul, do you want to give us the overview?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Every interim prior to the odd year long session, Legislative Council goes through the tax statutes and updates them for grammar and syntax, looks for obsolete statutes to delete, and other provisions. So Alan Dale at Council has prepared Senate Bill 148, and that's the goal is to make these technical changes. The intent is to avoid anything that has an impact on tax policy.
Great. Thank you. Yes, sir.
For the record, I'm Alan Dale, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Is that? Sounds like it's echoing here. Am I too close?
No.
Okay. So there are different ways I could go through. Everything that Chair Barnhart and Paul said is correct. They're clerical, non-substantive changes. Most of them are proposed internally within LC. We keep notebooks. But some of them were proposed by the Department of Revenue. So they are listed in numeric order, but there are sort of thematic clusters. A full half of all sections in the bill replace the term citizen with either resident, people, or individual. So if you want me to walk through it, I can do that or take questions.
Well, why don't we start with some questions, and then if we still need more, that would be useful.
Okay.
And let me start just so others can catch up. I'm assuming that the term resident has a specialized meaning, and that you're about to tell us what it is.
All right. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, so...
And citizen may have a different meaning. I don't know.
It's kind of a federal issue in a sense. A person, an individual, is a citizen of the United States. Oregon exercises jurisdiction over people by virtue of residence rather than citizenship. Sometimes, however, when a statute is, you might say, heads towards a policy statement, then the people of Oregon is more appropriate than resident. And sometimes, in one case in this bill, individual, which is a more specific form of jurisdiction, is more appropriate. So there are 7 changes from citizen to resident, 8 from citizen to people, and 1 from citizen to individual.
Okay. And does the term resident have it? Is that a term of art, or is it the common meaning of the word?
I believe it's the common meaning. It's someone whose principal residence is within the state of Oregon.
Okay. I have a recollection, which may not be accurate, that in order to be a resident, you have to be a citizen or a lawfully present alien in order to be a resident. But perhaps I'm just simply misremembering that.
I'm sorry, Chair Barnhart, I can't say, but it may change with context.
It may. All right. Good. Other questions? Hi. Should I schedule a test on this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Chair, if I could just...
Please.
In an unrelated matter and something we brought up in the Senate, but those of you that we've talked a lot about kind of the goals of the tax system, and one of the things that appears in this bill, just indirectly because it's tied to the technical changes, but if you look in Section 22 of the bill on page 12, under ORS 316.003, it does list what the legislature at the time, and I believe it was 1991, what the goals of the tax system are. So that, I think, is really the only place in statute where we have those stated. And I don't know if we've reviewed them in the past several times, but I think always something to look back on to think if that still makes is consistent with what you're thinking is in terms of what the tax system should do. So unrelated to the bill, but that section is a interesting one for tax policy.
I'm going to point this out the next time.
I think that that probably ought to be included in your next basic facts report.
And
this idea that we shield genuine subsistence income from taxation, that it's not regressive, imposes approximately the same tax burden on all households earning the same income, adequacy, flexibility.
Can I sue over these?
Great, great ideas. passed in 1991, you say?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay. Other comments? All right, well, I, with that, I think we'll close the public hearing on House Bill, or Senate Bill 148. Colleagues, we have two work sessions scheduled for today. I think what I'd like to do is repost them for Thursday. And since it is the current plan not to meet tomorrow, we'll repost for Thursday. Give members a chance to think some more about Senate Bill 148 and contemplate House Bill 3192, since that has to go to Ways and Means anyway, and they're not in the middle of hearing House Bill or these ancillary policy bills yet. There's no danger that we'll miss the time because we hold it till Thursday. In the meantime, we will ask Ledge Council to get an answer to my question about what the term resident means, which is the only possible thing I can think of in this bill that would actually change the meaning of some of those statutes. Mm-hmm. There may be some other things, but I don't see them.
Can residents vote? That's the main thing. It
depends on what the word means.
Yeah, not necessarily.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the order? I will tell you tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning, 8:30, we are going to sit with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee as their guests to receive the revenue estimate. And then immediately following that meeting, there'll be a meeting of the Joint Committee on Tax Reform to hear from Paul on the answer to some of the questions that were asked last week. But we will not be meeting at 1 o'clock. We will meet next. This committee will meet next on Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Anything else? Thank you very much. With that, committee's adjourned.